Not Quite Right features discussions that are unfiltered and uncensored and may include themes that are inappropriate for younger listeners. Also, I swear a lot.
Something doesn't seem quite right.
Welcome to Not Quite Right. My name is Ed. And this is the second of a series of interviews that Amanda and I recorded at the Words on the Waves Writers Festival this year. This time, we're speaking with Hugh McKay. Hugh McKay is a social psychologist. He was at Words on the Waves for his talk entitled The State of Australia Today. He's the author of 24 books, including The Way We Are, Lessons from a Lifetime of Listening. And we spoke with Hugh about the importance of listening and how to find connection in an increasingly isolated age. So here is our discussion with Hugh McKay. So we're here at Words on the Waves with Hugh McKay.
Good morning.
And you've just finished your talk in the Dip about the state of Australia today. So that sounds like quite a wide-ranging topic. Tell us about that.
Yes, it is a wide-ranging topic. How foolish I was to agree to cover all this in a short time. But, I mean, there are lots of ways of describing contemporary Australia. And it's easy to slip into negativity because we know that one of the characteristics of contemporary Australia is that we have a mental health crisis. Mm. We have epidemics of anxiety and depression and loneliness. We're gambling too much. We're not sleeping enough. We're over-medicated. We're overweight. You know, there's a long list of things you could say are problems with Australia. But this is not a negative book. What I'm trying to demonstrate is that over the last 30 or 40 years, there have been big social changes in Australia which have had the effect of making us more socially fragmented, more individualistic, at the expense of our mental health. We haven't understood what we were doing to ourselves. We've been shrinking our households.
Yes.
The biggest single household type in Australia, and the fastest growing household type, is the single person household.
Right.
And, of course, our households are getting smaller and our houses are getting bigger, which is a strange irony about Australia. A high rate of relationship breakdown, between 35 and 40% of marriages ending in divorce. Great mobility. We're moving house on average once every 6 years. We drive everywhere. We wave at our neighbour's car instead of stopping and talking to our neighbours. We're busier than we've ever been. We don't have time for social connection to the extent we should. And, of course, we've all fallen for the IT revolution where we're confusing contacts via screen-based devices with human communication, which relies most crucially on eye contact, which you can't have via a screen.
Yeah.
So all of those things taken together have had the cumulative effect. These are not things that were done to us.
Mm-hmm.
These are choices we've been making about how to live without understanding that for members of a social species, which humans are, I mean, we're built for connection, we're built for community, we're built for cooperation. And yet, in this very recent past, we've been making all these choices about how to live which have actually been going against our own human nature. And so it's not surprising that the consequence of this would be depression, anxiety. I mean, herd animals, when the herd disperses, they don't do well.
A lot of the issues that you mentioned, like that fragmentation of ideas and the individualistic thing, there used to be, I remember in like maybe it was the 90s, 2000s, a lot of talk about Americanization, like as a cultural force. I don't know if that's still talked about as much these days, but I think that's definitely like a driver of a lot of that individualistic mindset. And fragmentation in Australia is one thing and division, but compared to America, it's a very different thing.
Yes, absolutely right. But that's the direction we've been going. We, as you say, we've got a long way to go, and I hope we never get there.
Yeah.
I hope we're going to reverse these trends. That's the message of the book. We can do something about this, you know, rebuild local communities and watch out for people who are at risk of social isolation, be more alert to the needs of the lonely and the marginalized. But you're right. The example of America is very instructive. When your society is built on the cult of individualism and competitiveness, then it's going to be a damaged society. And neuroscientists tell us they can find in the human brain the cooperative centre. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's in our DNA to cooperate. There's no such thing as the competitive centre in the human brain. That's a learned response. Yes. But we have to nurture our capacity. And what drives our ability to cooperate is all the qualities you need to cooperate: kindness, compassion, tolerance, inclusiveness, etc. That's in us. That's innate to have those qualities, but we don't always nurture them.
Well, tolerance in particular feels like something that's a little bit in short supply at the moment.
Yeah. The more individualistic we become, the less tolerant, the more judgmental, the less compassionate, the less empathic. It's a dangerous trend. It's not irreversible, of course, and we're still doing I said in my little talk a moment ago, while we're thinking about the issues we have to address, we also need to remember that every day, all over Australia, millions of people are performing acts of kindness for each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's still a very positive society with these warning signs.
Yeah. So some of these problems that you mentioned, like universal, maybe Western problems, but a few of them are very Australian, I think. Like the gambling one is one that stands out to me. It's quite Australian. It's more so here, especially in New South Wales, than elsewhere, where we have pokie machines in every club and gambling ads on TV in the way that we wouldn't have had, you know, for smoking and alcohol. That's still completely rampant and a blight on our culture, I guess. So, yeah, I guess what are some of the ones that you see that really need to be addressed very, very soon?
Well, you mentioned one. We are, per capita, we are the world's biggest losers on gambling. That's an extraordinary and very sad aspect of Australian life that needs urgent attention. I think also we've got to pay attention to the household issue. I think that's urgent for us. We're talking about the housing crisis at the moment. Well, it's a very complicated crisis. We're a nation of spare rooms. And in fact, on census night, the last two censuses, there were 1 million empty dwellings.
Yeah.
Now, they're holiday houses and rental properties that weren't occupied and so on, but a million, you know, it's not 100,000, it's a million empty. So there's an oversupply in one sense.
Yes.
And there's this silly problem of the houses that we build and the apartments being much bigger than we need. So in the last 75 years, while the average size of the Australian household has been steadily shrinking, down now the average is 2.5 persons per dwelling, the average size of Australian dwellings has more than doubled. It's gone from 100 to 240 square metres.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I think we've got to have a serious rethink. And maybe house prices will force that rethink.
Mm.
I think there's going to be a lot more multi-generational households, a lot more people who'll decide that they can just tack a granny flat on, and, you know, and that'll be good. I mean, bigger, more chaotic, more fluid households are actually better for us, and especially better for the raising of children.
Yeah.
The nuclear family has not turned out to be a good model.
I'm very
raising kids.
Happy to hear that. Actually, I'm living in a multi-generational house right now. So my mom is living with us and with our children as well. So three generations under our roof. And I really love it. And we've talked, my mom and I have talked before about this issue that other people think is a problem, which I don't see as a problem, is the declining birth rate.
Mm.
Because there's this panic that there won't be enough taxpayers to sort of look after the non-taxpayers at the other end of the age spectrum.
Yes.
And, you know, our conclusion that we reached is, well, what's going to happen is it's going to force people to live in multi-generational households, because that's got to be an answer if there's not enough care facilities or whatever it might be, or care workers. That job is going to come back within the family in a way that perhaps it's been outsourced a little bit for a while.
Yes.
And I don't see that as a bad thing.
No,
I think
exactly.
That's wonderful. And in other cultures, that's normal.
It's absolutely normal. And it used to be for us.
Mm.
If you go back 100 years, we were typically three-generation households, the odd aunt or uncle coming and going, or a lodger. The situation you've described in your own household, very good for any children who are present, because they've got more than just mum and dad or mum as a model of how to behave as an adult. They've got another older person. very good for the parents because it's a grandparent who's sharing the load. I read recently about a human rights lawyer from Uganda who moved with her husband and two children to Switzerland because she got some job. And she said the contrast moving from the Ugandan village where she'd lived, where there was an extended family and the sense of the true village where, you know, you could park the kids, you know, you could park families that had lots of kids, just park them all with a neighbour while mum went off to get her hair done or something. No question, of course. Yeah. Suddenly moved to Switzerland, no family, the neighbourhood not functioning like a village. She said the burden of being a parent in a stripped down nuclear household crushed them. They found it almost intolerable, unmanageable after the experience of their home in Uganda.
Isn't it ironic that, you know, you think you're simplifying your life? You know, you think, oh, well, it's just two kids. It's not the 10 neighbours' kids from next door as well. But actually, it becomes harder because you're not sharing. And of course, people have different strengths and skills. And so one person's good at cooking, another person's great with kids and having fun. Like, you don't get to lean into your strengths either. You've got to be everything to those children all the time.
And that's right.
That's a lot.
Well, that lovely African saying, it takes a village to raise a child, it's absolutely true. And in good neighborhoods, even around Australia, there are lots of little streets and apartment blocks and so on around Australia that are functioning like villages. Very good for the kids.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it seems also to be a consequence of how we design our cities. I feel like people live very isolated lives. And when you look at new suburbs that are being built, like just kind of an ocean of houses that are separated from each other without any shared kind of community, there's nowhere to go in the area. Like, you don't have anywhere to walk around. You don't have that mixed business with houses. So everyone just goes home, gets in their car, goes to the shops, gets in their car, goes to work. It's very low trust as well in the area that you live in. You wouldn't feel comfortable just, apart from maybe your immediate neighbours, like just, oh, I've got to go out, I'm going to leave my kids with the neighbours. That just doesn't really happen. Yeah, everyone's kind of silent.
No, that's very true. And that model that you've just described is very widespread in outer metropolitan areas, especially around Australia. And even in regional areas, I spoke recently to a young woman who'd moved into a new housing subdivision in Orange in the central west New South Wales. And she said she's lived there for 6 months and hasn't yet met any neighbours.
Yeah.
Because they all come and go by car. They all have electric garage doors. So you drive up, the door goes up, you drive in, the door goes down. I did say you could go and knock on a neighbour's door. Oh, yeah, I'll get around to it. But 6 months and she still hadn't met anyone. So it's like a social desert.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as you say, then there's no coffee shop nearby, no sort of natural. We need places where we can incidentally contact and connect with each other, just passing in the street, say good day, stop, talk about the weather, anything, just to give people that sense of belonging. Which is absolutely fundamental because we belong to this species. The sense of belonging is fundamental to our mental and emotional health.
Yeah. And it's good that people are talking about this as well and recognizing that is a problem, but still you don't see anything changing from the perspective of, like, new housing developments aren't changing the way that they're being designed.
Some are. There are some very bright little lights.
We have one here not too far, I think, actually. Yeah, the Eco Village. And it's very much being designed with that in mind, that sense of community. And I know someone who lives there and she says her kids, it's like going back in time. They're all shoeless out in the street playing together. And, you know, it's that environment where you just expect your kids to come home when it gets dark and you trust all your neighbours. And and I just fantasise about moving there because it sounds absolutely beautiful.
Yes. And there are examples. Some developers have become very enlightened and understand, you know, you've got to get a GP coffee shop and a, you know, library or a community centre or a church or something before there are any people to go there, you know, even to subsidise some of these things in order to generate some kind of community hub from the beginning. So it is happening.
I keep hearing about like a Japanese model of these things. I'm not sure if you've heard of this, but just the idea of having a mixed community with businesses in the community. So, you know, houses on top of shops. And so there's actually a reason to walk out into the community and
exactly.
You don't need to all travel to Erin Affair, which is our local shopping center. You can just walk around and meet people and interact.
Yes. Well, the Eco Village near here that you met is a famous example of someone getting it right. A lovely example, not lovely, an awful example of getting it wrong is the decision that many local councils are now making, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, to go high-rise. Because we're all committed to this idea that there's a housing shortage. We've got to build, you know, I think it is, as I've suggested, more complicated than that. But the solution in so many places is go up. And going up 3 or 4 stories is fine. Medium density, very good for building a sense of community. Go much higher than that. I mean, Paris is a good model of low rise. Go high rise up 20 or 30 floors, and it has the opposite effect. People become obsessed with privacy and security, avoid eye contact in the lift, you know, don't talk to people in the car park. It's people crowded together too closely and community breaks down.
So you've talked about anxiety and depression. I'm interested in particular in social anxiety because I see like huge increase in social anxiety just even amongst friends and family and even myself who, you know, I'm an extrovert, but I find myself getting like as if I'm getting social anxiety. And I wonder what that stems from, because you're saying it's natural for us to want to be social. Yes. Yeah. And then we get an opportunity and where many people withdrawing away from that opportunity to connect with people, getting too scared to do so. So what are your thoughts on
Yes. I think we're getting out of practice. It sounds silly and almost too simple, but the more fragmented we become, the more fragmented we will become. And one of the things you find about people experiencing loneliness, for example, is they become less and less inclined to make social contact. They become more inward and, you know, will say, I think I'm better off on my own.
Yeah.
Whereas, of course, they're not.
No.
Once we start to lose a lot of spontaneous connection with people around us, then it's a strange psychological process where we start to feel scared. Another example of the same phenomenon with kids who had to be homeschooled during COVID. Record numbers now of kids experiencing this thing called school refusal. They're actually scared of going back into a crowded classroom because they've got out of practice at being social animals. So it's a fragile thing. And we really have to nurture it in our kids and in each other.
So how do you nurture it in your own life? What are the ways that you stay social?
I'm constantly saying, let's have a cup of coffee.
And, yeah,
and
that's simple.
Checking up on the neighbours and so on, yeah. But yeah, I'm like you, I'm naturally a bit of an introvert, so I have to remind myself that if I go a day without making eye contact with a number of people, that'll be very bad for my mental health.
Yeah, right.
And you can't do it on a screen. You think you're looking at someone's face on a screen, but you're looking at a screen. There's no eye contact there. And as an organism, we thrive on eye contact with each other. And when it's missing, we experience this thing. There's a Melbourne psychologist called Michelle Lim who's called this phenomenon social hunger. And she says, if you don't have enough social contact, you don't have enough eye contact, you start to experience social hunger, which has very similar symptoms to physical hunger.
Yeah.
You get cranky and irritable. And one reason why there's so much bad behavior on social media, bullying, trolling, abuse, etc., is that the heaviest users are socially hungry and they're angry and they don't know why.
And they're reaching out, but in these aggressive ways.
Yes.
Gosh, that's fascinating.
You can get into a downward spiral about all this. It's all reversible and it all starts in the street where you live.
Yeah.
You know, the state of the nation we can wring our hands about, but the state of the nation is an accumulation of all our streets.
Yes.
We just need to make sure that we're rebuilding the sense of community where we live.
So tell us a little bit about your book, The Way We Are. So you're saying you're exploring like the more positive aspects of relationships and being social. Like, what are some of the lessons? What are those positive aspects that you can share with us?
The absolutely crucial importance of listening.
Yeah.
Like you two have been doing very nicely. Thank you. When someone listens to you, the unspoken message is, I take you seriously enough to bother listening to what you're saying. I'm prepared to entertain your ideas. We might disagree violently, but just for the moment, I'm going to hear you out. And if you don't listen to someone, if you're looking at your watch or looking distracted or something, the unspoken message that you're sending is, I don't take you seriously enough to bother listening to what you have. I'm not even prepared to entertain your ideas. You'd never say that out loud to someone. It would be too offensive and hurtful, but that's the implication when we don't listen. Listening is the great therapeutic gift that we give each other. The test, I mean, it's not easy to listen, because the test of whether you're really listening to someone is whether you're prepared for the possibility that you might have to change your mind. And if you're not open to that, you're not really listening. You're just hearing. So I'm convinced that the breakthrough in personal relationships, even within a family, but among neighbors, strangers on a bus, work colleagues, anywhere, is rediscover the lost art of listening, and connections will follow. It doesn't mean we're all going to agree with each other, but it means we're going to hear each other.
I think that's very true. I think those conversations often don't happen when we're talking about people falling into different camps and different, especially political sides of their little ideology. And I think most people will gravitate towards friend groups and people who share the same views as they do, and often won't engage. And it's always kind of this fight rather than, you know, intention to actually listen and understand the other side of the story.
But social media exacerbates that too, because you get the, you know, a confirmation bias.
The echo chamber effect.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yes.
And we're also on the cusp of all of the AI, generative AI stuff that's going to make that even more complicated and more problematic. So
yeah, it's going to make it even more urgent to drop in and say good day to the neighbours. And look, keep an eye on that guy at the end of the street who's recently bereaved and maybe needs someone to say hello.
Yeah, more than just a message on their Facebook or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, an important conversation to be having, I think, definitely. So thank you for spending some time with us.
Great pleasure.
Yeah,
thank you
thanks
both.
So much.
This has been a special presentation of the Not Quite Right podcast in collaboration with Words on the Waves Writers Festival. Check the show notes for more information about Words on the Waves and the books mentioned in this episode. If you're new to the podcast, please join us again for our regular episodes where we talk about media, culture, and the art of writing.
Something doesn't seem quite right.